Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today on the show, my new pal, Kevin Martin from the band Candlebox. Now, Kevin is someone who I met because of another former guest of the show, Andrew Reich. Andrew hit me up after we did an episode of I Heard They Stream Live, where I was cracking on Candlebox and casting dispersions about the punk rock connection of this band. But then Andrew hit me up and said, no, Kevin's my buddy. And I got to say, he is definitely a punk rock guy. And after having this conversation with Kevin, yeah, 100%. I owe him an apology. And I apologize right off the top because I take Andrew at his word. And when Andrew said, no, he's into hardcore, he's into punk, I knew. So I apologize right off the bat. If you would like to go and see Candlebox, they're going to be playing this coming weekend, if you're listening to this, when this drops, at the K-Rockathon Reboot in Syracuse, New York. And they've got other shows coming up in September where they're going to be going on tour with The Who. Like the Who. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on too much more. This is a really fun conversation. If you want to get in touch with this podcast, you can hit us up at turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. This show's producer and guest booker, except for this episode, is Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for this show. And find me on Instagram or just Instagram, @LeftForDamian. Turn Out of Punk on all the other social media platforms, and there's YouTube channels. And I heard they stream live, streamed on the YouTube channel. Anyway, find that stuff over there. And that's it. Thank you, Andrew, for making this one happen. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Kevin Martin on Turned Out a Punk. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure, my man.
Well, as I spared you from hearing before we came on the air, like, I'm really excited that our mutual friend, Andrew Reich, friend of the show, reached out and said, no, you got to get Kevin on the show, because I feel like until I did the research for this episode, like, I don't think I ever really understood where you guys were coming from.
Right.
And I think around the time that everything was exploding for you guys, there was a lot of hate coming from various people in the media. And being a young person, I was kind of just susceptible to believing what I was hearing.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, oh, this band's a lot more complex than I ever thought. And certainly much more rooted in punk rock than I ever thought. So I'm excited for you to be here, Kevin.
Oh, cool, man. Thank you. I it's funny that a lot of people, the same thing. It's like they think of Candlebox as, you know, the kind of the late comers out of the Seattle music scene, and, you know, the kids riding on the coattails of everybody else. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we were 5 and 6 years in age younger than all those guys. And Seattle at the time was a city where you couldn't play in a bar unless you were 21 years old. So, you know, we were playing friends, you know, basement house parties and crap like that. And in a very punk rock way. So, and I think punk rock's a very misunderstood word or phrase.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of insecurity, not just in punk, but in all of music. And now being someone that obviously didn't go through what you guys went through, but went through my own little version of the thing with my band.
Yeah.
Coming through it, you realize how much of how much of my adolescent sort of music view and even my experience being in a band was kind of shaped by insecurity, and like a lot of stuff I threw at other bands was kind of born more out of my shit than their shit.
Yeah.
But this isn't about my therapy, this is about your journey. So I got to start it off, Kevin, the way they all start off, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, I had an older sister who was really into the Cars and new wave. I was born in 1969. It's a great year to be born, and of course the 70s was a really pivotal musical movement for I think a not only punk bands but rock and roll in general. But I think that cool new wave movement that was going on was something that I was really interested in. So I remember the hearing the Cars for the very first time. I think I was in fourth grade or third grade, and I kind of just fell in love with the tone and everything that was going on with it. And I really kind of was enamored with the lyrical writing and the musicality of the band. And then I remember the very first time I heard The Clash, and I was like, okay, this is it. What is this? And that was when I would have been about 8 years old. So, right before turning 10 and kind of going in on my way to San Antonio, Texas. Hearing a Clash for the very first time was the real game changer for me, because I loved everything that they had to say. And I felt like, as the youngest in a family of four and not getting, the attention that I deserved from my father, who was a traveling salesman, I had a lot of angst. I had a lot of I was probably a depressed kid as well. So punk rock kind of fulfilled that for me. The Clash certainly did. And then it was Ramones and the list goes on and on, Talking Heads and whatnot. So, but yeah, I think it was probably just that very first time I heard, Supermarket or any of those classic. I really love the melodic element of the Clash, the punk rock melodic element of what they were doing. And I find that the Ramones is a very similar thing for me. It's so ear candy, it's so hooky. And it just sucked me in, just like, the Cars did.
So where were you before you were in San Antonio?
I was living in Hutchinson, Kansas.
Okay. Well, I guess there wasn't, was there much new wave stuff kind of being played on the radio? Was it college stations? Like, where would you
It
be?
was college. Yeah, it was, my sister was going to Washington or Wichita State University, and they had a really great college station there. I think it was like 75 or 76 is when she was there, or 77. And yeah, that's kind of, she started bringing the 8-track. She had an 8-track player in her Ford Mustang. She had a 69 Ford Mustang. And so she had all these great little 8-track cassettes, and she'd pop them in there and she'd drive me around. And see, my sister was my best friend growing up, and she could just turn me on to everything musically that I appreciate now. And then of course my older brother Dennis turned me on to, Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. But my sister was really kind of the one who got me into it.
Those punk rock 8-tracks now are like crazy, crazy
Yeah,
collectible.
and hard to find.
Oh, super hard to find. I've got a friend who's a deep 8-track collector, and I've given him a list of stuff to look for, but they never show up, you know? I guess they didn't survive, right?
No, I don't. I mean, it's it, the problem is that people left them in their hot cars, and I mean, it was a great concept, quarter inch tape. That's what you mix a record down to, and it's supposed to sound great. But yeah, I mean, if you find them and they're working in any way, shape, or form, that's because somebody took great care to make sure that they lasted a lifetime. And there's very few people that do that anymore, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's like there's a documentary, So Wrong They're Right, I think, about eight tracks and the sort of art and the craft of like repairing eight tracks and splicing it all back together. Like, that's a dying art.
It is. It is. Well, making records to tape, and having your engineer cut your edits out of, trusting him not to fuck it up. That was like, that is a lost art. Nowadays, you can make your record in anything you want.
Yeah, it feels like the barrier of entry has gotten so low, but with that sort of the I don't know, artistry. I don't want to be too pretentious with it, but like sort of the craft has also diminished a little bit, because like you don't have people, as much as I love the people I work with engineers wise, they're not cutting things with razor blades in the studio
No,
and gluing it
they're
back
not
together.
going whoop, 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 whoop. There's the cut. Yeah, it was an art form, and I think I've watched that documentary, and it's fascinating because for those of us who grew up with 8-track tapes, born in the 60s and 70s, whatever, it is a very fond memory, and coming across those things, like there's the swap meet here in Los Angeles, you can find them at, and or you go out to the Rose Bowl and you can find them out there. And it just takes me back to that, sitting in the passenger seat of my sister's Mustang, just listening to great music,
So you moved to San Antonio. What's it kind of like? What's a culture shock like, first of all, moving from one to the other?
Well, I went from a school that had 75 kids to a school that had 2,500. I was the weird kid from Kansas, where everybody was like, "Yeah, you're not from Kansas anymore," that kind of bullshit. But the culture shock was pretty much just the size of it. You know, I moved a lot. My father was born in Chicago, and he was a salesman for a salt company. So we moved a lot when I was a kid, and I had to make friends very quickly. So I was kind of a person's person. So when I moved to San Antonio, I was shocked that it was so difficult to meet people, because I figured I'm going from 100 kids to, you know, to 2,000. So this can't be too difficult. But, you know, literally the first couple months that I was in my middle school, I didn't know anybody. No one would talk to me. You know, I was the weird kid from Kansas. So that just kind of fueled the, you know, the frustration and the anger a little bit more for me. But yeah, I just kind of found there were two kids that I was going to school with, Allison and Brent, who kind of were cut from the same cloth as me. It was parents weren't really around that much. A lot of family, but nobody really hanging out. And they took me to this teenage club. I can't remember what it was called. It was down by this place called Blossom Athletic Center. I saw this band. I think they were called the Modals or something. And they played nothing but like New York pop punk. And I was immediately like, oh, this is great. I know these songs. I know every one of these songs. And so I was lucky enough to at that point really get influenced by what was going on and inspired by what was happening in San Antonio in the music scene. And then of course I went to MacArthur High School right after eighth grade, and that's where I met Trent from Marching Plague, and you know, that was where it all started for me. I was like, this is the greatest movement in the history of rock and roll as far as I was concerned, you know. But yeah, San Antonio and Texas had that, you know, they had the amazing punk rock scene. It's like, you know, it's second to none, and some of the greatest, you know, coolest bands ever have come out of Texas.
Did the Modells record a 7-inch? Because it sounds super familiar. But I mean,
They may have.
damn, I gotta like I'm I think I might even have it for some reason. Like it's kind of.
They were a cool band. I mean, they were college kids. I think they were going to UTSA, which is University of Texas San Antonio, and they would play these all ages shows. I actually saw the B-52s at that same club, which I think is crazy as well. But yeah, it was very cool, man. And I think they may have made one or two 7 inches, or maybe, you know, some 12 inches, some EPs.
What about there's that pre believe me, we're going to talk Marching Plague in a second, but there's that pre-Marching Plague band Mystery Dates.
I never knew them.
Okay. And
Never knew them.
I think there was a band called the Vandals that might have become Marching Plague actually.
Yeah, could have been. Could have been.
So was there like a big scene in San Antonio? Because as you said, Texas is there's so much incredible punk out of there, but like when you go to Texas, it definitely culturally does not seem as welcoming as like New York would be.
Yeah, San Antonio and Austin did. I mean, you know, you had Marching Plague, you had Fearless, Everydance from Hell, the Hicoids, World Bazaar, which came out a little bit later than that. There was a really kind of cool dark metal scene. But yeah, there was San, and of course, in Austin, you had Flipper and Big Boys, Butthole Surfers, and all that stuff. So yeah, the actual crowd and Texas scene was really, really prominent. I mean, it was very strong. I mean, there were great shows in Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio. You know, I mean, it was. I think there's actually a book Andrew gave me years ago called "The Texas Punk Rock Scene," and it just really describes all of those bands. A lot of the bands, like you mentioned, that I had never heard of. You know, I left San Antonio in 1984 to move to Seattle, so I think maybe a lot of that stuff came after that, but. You know, there was the Bone Club, there was the SBC Hall. That's where the first concert I went to, which is Black Flag and Dead Kennedys, which was you know, mind-blowing for me, a 12-year-old kid about to turn 13. And my best friend Reagan, who I went to high school with, she was a punk rock cheerleader. She's now a teacher actually at MacArthur High School, but the most punk rock person I know that I've ever known. And she took me to my very first concert. But she worked at a record store called Hog Wild Records, and that's where I got a lot of my 12 inches and 7 inches and stuff like as well, because it was a very magical thing. And then when I moved to Seattle, you know, of course you had and, you know, Fallout Records and all that sort of stuff. So it was a very similar climate, just not as punk rock as San Antonio was. It was a little more on the heavy side of things.
It's funny though, like Texas, because I guess maybe it's a stereotype too I have as a Canadian about it. And like certainly in my experience going down there, like It is. There are tons and tons of cool people, but it's amazing how many weird bands came into Texas. Like, it's a real, like the stuff that was coming out of there. And I guess that's maybe if you're going to go weird, you might as well go all the way when you're in a place like that. And so, like the big boys, like you said, but like also all that stuff on CIA Records, like where Marching Plague would put out their 7-inch, like all that stuff is so awesome. My Doll, and like it's a great period for like American music everywhere, but particularly Texas for me.
It was, I mean, it was so strong, and it was great when these Texas bands got to play with the DC punk or the California punk. It was, I saw Minor Threat when I was 13 years old. I mean, these are things that I still to this day I'm like, man, how the hell was I able to experience some of these amazing moments in rock and roll history? And I'm so grateful that I guess, as a teenager, you hate your parents when they move you, but then you get to experience something that's life-changing. And later on down the road, you go, hey, Dad, I really love you. I know I was an asshole when I was a teenager, but thanks for taking me to San Antonio, Texas, and then moving me to Seattle, Washington, because of course my career started in Seattle. But yeah, I mean, it was a lot of those Texas bands that I grew up loving and listening to. And also I'm more on the side of, I think Andrew's a little bit, he's got way more historical knowledge of the punk rock scene in Texas than I do, just because he's such a deep dive guy. But I know a lot of those bands. I went to school with some of those guys, and I wish that I had been able to kind of keep in touch with them in a weird sort of way, because I know I've lost track. I can't find Trent anywhere. And there's another guy named Mike Kokinda, who was just one of the coolest punk rock guys I'd ever seen, and as a freshman, and kind of took me under his wing and took me to a lot of those shows with Reagan as well. I can't find those guys anymore, and I would love to have an opportunity to sit down with them and say, man, you really inspired me as a young kid and changed my life. When I toured with Henry Rollins in Europe, in 1994, I was so starstruck. I couldn't talk to him for the whole tour, and he actually came to me at the last show, in Hamburg, and was like, what's wrong with you? And I was like, man, I got to tell you a story. When I was 12 years old, I went to see you play with the Dead Kennedys in San Antonio. He's like, okay. I said, I did a stage dive, hit the ground. You saw that nobody picked me up. You grabbed me. I sang the second verse of Damage with you, and then you pushed me off the stage. He's like, you're that kid? And I was like, it's because he remembers everything. And I said, yeah, that was me, and you just changed my life. And I said, I'm sorry, but I'm kind of trying to take all this in. I'm actually on tour with you. You're one of my favorite artists of all times. And I just don't know. I don't know how to express to you or to show to you what it meant to me as a 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid.
I think it's interesting also, obviously, your story being incredibly personal with Rollins, but I feel like just in general, what a cultural figure he was in that early 90s period, where he's kind of like the proto Joe Rogan, and not in a negative political way, I mean, but like in this sort of like people read his books, people like worship, not worship, but like, aspire to be like him, like train their bodies to be like him. Like people have come on this podcast and talked about it, like ever since I started doing it. And it's interesting. There was this sort of Rollins cult of personality in that period too. So I guess that would be coupled on the fact that you also met him at 12 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because, again, I'm going to go back to San Antonio. How many great shows? I mean, we saw shows at Alamo Heights High School Coliseum, and I saw Black Flag there. It's like the opportunities that you had back then, you just don't have anymore, and so being able to get to know Henry on that tour and just get to know him by watching him every night and kind of understanding how much energy he really put into his music and what it meant to him. And of course he's an icon, and to this day, he refuses to sell out, and it's the coolest fucking thing, because he's such a badass and he's such a great guy, and he's so honest and sincere that, it's like the same with Ian. And you have to respect that these guys are the shit that killed Elvis in so many ways, and so have so much great respect for the art itself and the bands. Henry didn't have to take Candlebox on the road. He took us because he liked the music. I mean, he told me that. He's like, I like the band. I like what you stand for. I like where you come from. And he goes, now I like you even more. You know, when I told him the story, that to me is, you know, not a lot of bands get that opportunity, and not a lot of bands get somebody that they really admire tell them, I don't hate your music. I actually like your music, and fuck all the haters, you know. And that's kind of how he was, and that's what he said to me. And you know, and that's just that's a great gift, you know, as a young man.
Well, because you're going also right from that Metallica Suicidal Tour to a tour with Rollins Band. So you're dealing with sort of these big, sort of legendary punk rock personalities. Metallica, obviously, being a legendary in different worlds, but like Mike Muir and then Rollins, like it must have been intimidating to be sort of a young person out there kind of doing this for the first time, or like second times, I guess, touring, but like that you're out with these big, huge bands, but also like heroes of you as a kid, like punk rock heroes.
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, the Metallica tour was really, really hard. Basically, because you know, you throw the name Candlebox in between Suicidal Tendencies and Metallica, it sounds silly, you know. And I'm sure that you know, and maybe you don't, but you know, Alice in Chains was supposed to be the direct support on that, and Lane went into rehab. So, and at that point, our record was doing so well that we got direct support. And sadly, Mike Muir did not like that. You know, he hated us, and he threatened our lives in San Francisco if we didn't swap shows. This is probably something I probably shouldn't be telling, you know, anyone, but it was really hard for me because I actually said to him in San Francisco when he came to our dressing room, I was like, dude, you know, I looked up at you as a young man, as something that you stood for something bigger than you are. And right now I see that it's just ego, and it really breaking me. And I don't like you so much right now because this is not the person I thought you were, and this is not what I thought Suicidal stood for in the punk rock world. I go, I guess I was wrong, you know. And that was a really hard thing to swallow because I'd never experienced that much hatred at any point in my life. Even when I got beat up the very first time in middle school, I didn't experience this kind of, like, this guy wanted us to die because he had to go on before us. It was a strange, strange thing. And I don't know how he is now. I obviously didn't speak to him the whole tour. We had to kind of stay away from one another. He was told by, you know, Metallica's team that, you know, if he fucked with Candlebox, he was off the tour. It was a really strange thing. And I'm sure he's a lot different now, but back then it was a, you know, I was a 24-year-old kid being threatened by somebody that I really, really admired and looked up to as a young man, and it was a strange, strange thing. So going out with Henry was a light at the end of the tunnel sort of thing for me, you know.
It's also like it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like that ego thing. And I think lead singers in particular, we have two instruments. Like, obviously, you're a much more talented lead singer than myself, but we have two instruments. We have our voice and then we have our ego. And our ego is like our shield, and our swords, like our sword is our voice, I guess. And so you need that armor. And then as soon as that ego gets chipped away at, like, you're like, oh my God, this is my armor. So I think it brings out the worst in people. Well, I know it does.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, it's we've seen it on, you know, on every level, as artists, and you know, you try your hardest to not be that person. But it's really easy to get sucked into it, man. And I certainly can empathize with Mike and Suicidal for having to go on before Candlebox. I mean, it's not how it was supposed to be. And, you know, and in his mind, and even in mine, I'm like, I still am like, why the fuck did we open for Metallica? Like, as direct support. And I know why. It was because we were selling records, and it sold tickets, and, you know, and that sort of thing. And you know, I think Metallica genuinely liked us. I mean, we hung out with those guys a lot, and they were, you know, great dude. Every time I see Lars now, it's like, what's going on the band? How you doing? What's happening? You know, that's an interesting thing. But when that ego gets in your way, man, if you don't have someone around you to kind of check it for you, you're you know, it's a no-go. You just gotta kind of make sure that you can check yourself, you know, check your head sort of thing. It's like, I had those moments myself, you know, where I'm sure I said dumb shit, but I've always tried to try and, you know, stay as grounded as I can and remember where I came from and who I am and how I was raised and those types of things, and not to treat people poorly, just because I feel, you know, threatened.
Yeah, and it's like the whole system's designed, like I say this on the show quite a bit, but like it takes a special kind of mental health issue to make someone want to be the lead singer of a band, you know, to like get up there and take all that shit and kind of carry everything on your back in a way. And no one else in my band would agree that I'm carrying everything on my back, but like it does take that kind of mental defect to make you want that. But then at the same time, it's the worst mental defect to have when you finally get it, because there is this sort of like insecurity ego thing that's just constantly playing at you when you're the lead singer, and everyone else in the band can retreat into their instruments. Like you've been a drummer, you know, you can always look down at the tom. I don't know anything about drums, so that's why the first one popped in my head. But as a lead singer, all you do is you see the faces, you see how many people are there, you see if people are leaving, you see their engagement. Like you, it's just constantly on you as a lead singer.
Yeah, and that's a great way to put it, because it's really what it is. And you do see when everybody gets up and leaves. You do see when people are yawning. You do see when people are talking. And it's like, fuck, man. I thought we had it. I thought this was it, and everybody's gonna pay attention to us. Well, they do for a minute, but it's like, I think for me, starting out as a drummer is probably what helped me kind of be able to squelch that ego centric attitude that some of my band members had. I mean, my guitar player Pete, back in the 90s, had way more ego than me, and I think that's kind of funny because it's like, I mean, I don't know, he was nominated as best new guitar player in Rolling Stone Readers Poll in 94. I mean, all these kinds of things. Then we made a record where he's like, I don't want to play solos. So I was like, oh, okay. You just won as a solo, one of the best new guitar players and lead players, and now you don't want to play solos on a record. Okay. I mean, that's what we're going to do. I mean, that's how we're going to play it. And but yeah, I think being a drummer kind of helped me to just step back at times and go, just let this kind of mull, let's mull this over. It'll roll away by itself at some point, and we'll get back to what we need to do. But I did, again, I had those moments, I'm sure, where I've done things and said things that are ridiculously stupid on stage. And it's you put it perfectly. Yeah. Watching people leave or, that sort of shit, it is all on your shoulders. You are carrying a lot of the weight of that show. And you are carrying the weight of the record. If you're the singer, if your voice sucks, nobody wants to listen to you. If your lyrics sucks, nobody wants to listen to you. I was a huge fan of SNFU when I was growing up. And I always thought that
Chai
that
Pitch.
he had one of the most interesting ways of singing and phrasing and lyrical content. I loved him, and I just thought, God, man, if I can ever figure out how somebody like that does it, I'll be a great singer. And that's kind of how I approached, Candlebox. When I sang on that record, that was my first record I ever sang on. I hadn't sung in a band before. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I'd sung in choir. It was whatever classes you need to fulfill your grades and stuff. So I took choir every year, but I'd never wanted to be a singer in a rock band. I'd seen bands where I was like, oh, I'd like to do that. It's cool. But then I always ended up watching the drummer. So, kind of being influenced by guys like Chai and Henry is what helped me to kind of get through that first album, because I really didn't know what to do.
Yeah, it's interesting with Chai Pitch, because I think to me he's the Canadian HR. Like he's up like maybe right after HR is one of the greatest front people of all time. And I think Canadian inferiority complex just has left him completely unacknowledged in this country. And it's amazing how many people he influenced, because he was such a dynamic performer, such a dynamic vocalist. Like you're right, no one talks about his vocals being awesome, but they're incredible.
Killer, killer singer.
Yeah. And I guess, being a drummer and a lead singer, that all those drummer jokes were just lead singers coming up with them to help us to hide in plain sight.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's always the most grounded member of every band that I find is the drummer.
Poor bastards.
Yeah. All right. Well, no, something that definitely wasn't stupid, something that was genius. What was the deal with Radical Youth Penis Department?
Penis Brigade.
Penis Brigade,
RYPB.
sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, Penis Brigade.
That was I did a lot of drugs in high school, and I had a friend that we started this kind of it was we were a two-piece band, kind of like Japan Droids, just noisy rock and roll. And we needed a band name, and my buddy was just he was obsessed with drawing penises. And I was like, dude, it's like, you just, this is ridiculous. It's on everything. What is your obsession with this? So he just was like, well, I think the band should be called Radical Youth Penis Parade. And I was like, okay, I'm not really sure what that means, but we are radical youths, and you are a penis brigade captain, so that's what we are. So, and then literally, I don't, we don't, we I, we did a couple shows in my basement and in some friends' basements, but nothing ever came of it. I had hoped that it would have, because we had some really cool music, but we never recorded anything. And it was really, really just, actually, it was more like, I guess, Death from Above. Now, it was that kind of just visceral punk rock noise. Gentry would play a keyboard, and then he'd play a guitar, and then he'd grab a bass, and like whatever he could get his hands on, and he would just, rip it to shreds, and I would just sit back there and bang the shit out of my, vintage Ludwig kick, and hope that somebody was listening. And we played to, five or six people here and there, and had a good time. But it was my way of getting rid of the angst and aggression I had from at that point moving to Seattle, because I was a skateboard kid in Texas, and I moved to a city where, it was raining, 12 months out of the year, and I couldn't skateboard anywhere. So all I had to do was sit in my basement and play music with my buddy.
Did you have any bands when you were in San Antonio? Or play drums there?
No, I played drums. I started playing drums in band in sixth grade, but I didn't have any bands in San Antonio. I was more interested in skateboarding and BMX and going out and seeing shows. And I didn't really know any musicians, again, except for the seniors in my high school. None of the kids that I was in, freshman, sophomore year, played any instruments that I knew of. A couple years later, my buddy Marshall, who was in eighth grade when I was a freshman, he kind of went on to do some cool shit. And then, of course, Chris Mackay, I don't know if you know Kirst Mackay, he had some cool shit, but I didn't know that they played any instruments, so I never started a band in Texas. It was in Seattle.
Did you go to Roosevelt High in Seattle?
No, I went to Mercer Island. It
Okay.
was a little island in between Bellevue and Seattle.
It's interesting when you look at some of those high schools and you go through it, like that, talk about such a potent scene and place for musicians. Like it's crazy, all these musicians that were in classes together or in school together. Like it was a great, like you kind of need that, I guess, to have that explosion that kind of comes out of Seattle at that time. And I don't mean just the grunge thing. I mean like everything that kind of happens, but you kind of need that period where every single person's got, I guess, a basement and stuck indoors because of the rain. And they're like, what are we going to do? But we might as well play these damn instruments and figure something out.
Well, I think that's why that Seattle sound is what it is. I mean, it's not just the drugs. I mean, of course, there were a lot of drugs, but it was the fact that you were stuck in your basement and, you're down tuning. I mean, Tad is one of my favorite bands from Seattle, and some of the coolest music ever written. And they weren't even from Seattle. The interesting thing is the majority of the big bands were from the islands. Like Cornell was not, didn't grow up in Seattle. He was a Bainbridge or Bremerton Island. All the Mother Love Bone guys, Jeff and Stone were all from, Jeff is from Montana. I mean, it's kind of like somehow, they found one another either in the city or if they were Roosevelt or some of the other high schools. I mean, a lot of the bands, like Jerry and Lane, those are down in Des Moines, down by SeaTac Airport, but again, part of the Seattle community. But not really. I don't know if there's one. I mean, I'm sure there probably is one band that came out of Roosevelt that were like all friends. I'm sure there were guys that were, because Roosevelt was really the main high school in Seattle proper that was public. But I don't know of any bands that were like all four or five guys were from one high school. You know what I mean?
I think in the first wave of Seattle stuff, like even like the pre-recorded, like Telegraphs and
Oh, Roosevelt.
Tupperwares, yeah, like the Roosevelt, that kind of era. But like you're right, like Tad's from Iowa. Like that's why it was so funny when like, well, at the time I didn't know, but like now realizing that when Courtney Love was going after you guys for not being from Seattle and moving there, she's not from Seattle.
No. See, that was funny, man. I mean, she was so misdirected and so angry with us, hated us, and Barty, Pete, and Scott were all from Seattle, or well, Bellevue, Seattle, whatever, in the surrounding areas. I'm the one that moved there, and I think that the misconception about all the Seattle bands is they were all from Seattle. Everybody's like, oh, they're from Seattle. They're from Seattle. Not really. I mean, from maybe around it or other cities or other states, but they found the music in Seattle. They found themselves in Seattle, and that's where they created that sound. And it could be said the same for the Athens music scene or the New York music scene or San Antonio or the LA or San Francisco. I mean, even Portland, most of those bands aren't from Portland. I think, maybe the Dandy Warhols and some of those kinds of what was it? Elliott Smith's first band. Yeah, Heat Miser, kind of Portland bands. But yeah, everybody found themselves in those cities. And that's what made it so kind of special. But sitting in your basement drinking beer, and not being able to go outside created some amazing music and a great movement.
And I think people moving there, like you're saying, like I never thought about this till now, but like that's what creates this cross-pollination is people moving from other cities where they had other influences. Like you look at Washington, D.C. and that early Discord scene. I love all those bands, but they all have a very similar approach in Sonic. And it's not until Minor Threat goes to Texas and Ian MacKaye sees the Big Boys and then they hear the Empire record that they wind up changing, doing Embrace and then it goes on Rites of Spring and then Fugazi out of that. But it's. You really do need that kind of cross-pollination to bring these other influences there. Otherwise, everyone's going to sound the exact same.
And I mean, the interesting thing about Seattle is none of the bands sound the same. I
No.
mean, it's like it's really just it's just a territorial kind of sound, or territorial pissings, if you will, like Nirvana wrote. I mean, it's just kind of people were trying to find their place, and they did, and they succeeded, tenfold from that place. But there's so many great bands that never even went anywhere, and or did, but just kind of got lost in the shuffle of all the other shit. I don't know, Candlebox, we're the luckiest four sons of bitches from that s music scene that I know of, and because there are so many bands we played with that were so much better than us and had better songs and better front men, and like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I was staring at the drums half the time, like you said, just to kind of get used to being on stage. And then having to tap into those memories of, oh, Henry Rollins would do this, maybe I can do this. I had to think about how do I be a front man for a band. It's like I'm used to sitting back here doing this, and but some of these bands that we played with, or like I know you were talking with Ken, was it from Fastbacks you had
Oh
on a
yeah,
couple weeks?
Kurt.
Kurt, sorry. I want to say Ken Stringfellow, but yeah, Kurt. I mean, I saw that band so many times. I loved that band. I saw them with the Posies. I saw them with the U-Man. I mean, one of my favorite bands of all time, and really don't get the credit they deserve. I mean, they were kind of with the Screaming Trees, the godfathers and godmothers of the Seattle punk rock and roll music scene, grunge scene, if you want to call it that, whatever. It just so good. So good, so many great songs, and just don't get. I mean, they do, of course, in the the Experience Museum they have up there at the Experience Museum, where they've got the Seattle scene and all the stuff that's going on in there. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff about them in there, but nobody really talks about them in the history of what really happened. And unless you're doing deep dives like your podcast does and other stuff like that, where you want to tell the story, people want to know what's going on, like Andrew did with the Red Cross documentary. I mean, Red Cross was so influential on the Seattle music scene, and Andrew did it perfectly in that documentary, how he explained it. And it's, they just kind of inspired so many of those Seattle bands. It's fascinating that, this quirky little California band came up there and everybody's like, wait, what is this? This is the coolest thing ever, And that's a great thing. Again, cross-pollination. Even though they didn't move to Seattle, they brought that style of music up there. And then all of a sudden you've got this kind of great pop, jingly, cool, sparkly rock and roll coming out of Seattle. And it was great,
Well, that was the best thing about that kind of mid-80s period, because certainly there was Maximum Rock and Roll and there's a little coverage going on in Spin, but for the most part, it's just kind of word of mouth going into the record store. Someone's like, have you heard this? And playing you something. And so you do have like this really exciting period where, yeah, like Red Cross is going around, like it, a DOA too, like DOA coming down to the US, and you hear every band from Seattle or bands from DC talking about, oh yeah, DOA came to town. And we were all like, okay, we got to take this seriously now. And we got to change our approach. Or Black Flag, famously, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And DRI. I mean, DRI was another one that I loved. The Minutemen, the Meat Puppets. I mean, there's like all of it was, it was so important to, I guess, my growing up and my musical taste and what I love about music and my songwriting approach. You know, I don't shy away from, you know, from politics, and I don't shy away from my emotions and my frustrations and my anger and, or my love or my empathy or my compassion. You know what I mean? It's all, I throw it in there because those bands that I saw at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, that changed my life, inspired everything that I do. And I remember seeing DRI, they came down and played this under an overpass in Tacoma. I forget what the venue was called, but they ripped the place apart, man. It was one of the greatest fucking shows I'd ever seen. And I was like, how come I don't know this band? Like, that was the first time I'd heard of them. But I was completely floored and forever a fan. You know, the English punk rock scene, I really loved, you know, Peter and the Test Tube Babies and, you know, kind of the quirky poppy shit I really loved. And then, you know, Sex Pistols, Exploited, whatever, you know, but all of that stuff is, it's so, so, so important to kind of what happened to the scene I grew up with in Seattle. I mean, it's all there. You know, if you look and listen, you'll find all those bands and all the Seattle bands, you know, it's all there. And that's why I think it was such an important movement. And I don't think, you know, I don't think the world, maybe the United States, will ever see that kind of musical creativity again from one little town. If that's how I'm supposed to say it. I don't even know if I'm saying it the right, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Life is a workout. And Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Well, it's so different now to think of a geographically centered music scene, because most of the big, sort of not big, but like interesting music scenes that kind of happen after it seem a lot more decentralized now. Like you've got like that emo rap kind of thing that happened. It was all over the United States, all these different groups kind of converging on the internet and kind of working together, doing stuff. But you're right, like a geographically centered scene just feels like, well, I guess you see it a little bit, like the stuff that's happening in Baltimore right now with or DC with Turnstile and those types of bands all kind of coming together.
Great band, Turnstile.
It's cool. Like, it's an interesting moment because now hardcore, for the first time maybe ever, And I mean, capital H hardcore, bands that are waving the flag, calling themselves hardcore, is popular, which it was always kind of, like we've been talking about, kind of the outsider's music. So it's interesting to see what the after effects of this moment's going to be.
Yeah. And also, like, everything that's going on with the Cro-Mags and you know, the documentary, is that documentary coming out on
The Harley one?
The Harley. It's supposed to come out soon, right?
Yeah. I think they're doing festivals, or no, he's doing screenings now with it. So I'm sure it's going to be streaming.
I mean, what a great fucking band, man. Like, first time I heard those guys, I was like, okay, this is hardcore and I love this. And H2O, you know, I'd never got to see those guys live. And then I did a charity thing 3 months ago for a friend who's got cancer, and I met Todd and I forget the singer's name, but they're brothers. Yeah. And they were like, wait a second, you grew up on us? I was like, dude, I have everything you released. Like, I didn't even know I was talking to them. Like, I had no idea. I've known Todd for a few years now. I had no idea he was in the band. Like, because we never talked about the hardcore scene. We only talked about like what he was doing with Juliet Elix or with, you know, Petty Cash, and he plays guitar in The Offspring. And, you know, that's all our conversation was always kind of around that. So when he's like, wait a second, you're excited to see H2O? I said, dude, I've never seen him. He's like, you do know I'm in the band. I'm like, what are you fucking talking about? He goes, that's me and my brother's band. I'm like, no way. I had no clue. You know, because again, that kind of great faceless punk rock. It's like you saw pictures, but you didn't put two and two together of who the guys were, you know. And I mean, I'm an idiot because I should have known that I'm standing here talking with, you know, two of the coolest dudes in punk rock history. I know there's the difference between like their hardcore and what hardcore is now, but you know, it's still kind of, to me, it's great that people are able to make this music today and it never stopped and people can hear it and people can be inspired by it. They can understand, learn something, embrace it, you know, whatever. And it's loud and it makes you feel something, you know, it's what's missing in kind of popular music right now is you can be Beyonce and still be punk rock. You know, you can be Taylor Swift and still be punk rock, but you're not, because you know, it's about that formulaic thing where it's just about selling, you know? And not to knock those ladies, because God, fuck, their careers are unbelievable, but it's so kind of just vanilla, you know? And I love Neapolitan ice cream, and that's why I think I love punk rock, and every aspect of it is because you get all these different flavors, and you never know which one of them is going to be, you know, the flavor of the day. But if you take a bite into it and you like it, you'll hang on to it. Vanilla is vanilla, you know, and I'd rather skip the vanilla part of that, you know.
It's the only genre on earth that says, yeah, no talent, no problem. Come on.
Exactly.
Bring whatever you got. And I think that's why it keeps being so vibrant, because it tells young people, or anyone, I guess, that comes to it, like, you can do this. Anyone can do this. And some of the greatest recordings were made by people with very little skill. And,
oh man.
And that's not to undercut some of the bands with tons of skill too, but I just think that's the thing that makes this amazing, is that you can have someone hitting a chair, screaming into a microphone, and it receives equal weight as television, or you know, like a band that actually is really applying and trying to hone their craft. But it's all good, because it's all just about honest expression, and whatever that honest expression is, as long as it rings true to people, this genre will privilege that.
It's very important, you know, it's very important that continues, because that is the one thing, you know, certainly in this day and age with the world we're living in, what we're seeing going on here in Los Angeles and you know, the current administration, it's really important that this kind of music is out there, you know. I mean, Tom Morello, like him or not, and I love him to death, and I love what he does. That guy puts himself in the middle of it all the fucking time, because he believes in it. He believes everything he says. He believes everything he writes, and he wants to go out there and he wants to march with the immigrants. He wants to let people know that this is not okay. You know, I'm not that person. I wish I was. I wish I had that kind of, I don't know what the word is. I live a little bit in fear of that, because I'm not the type of person that wants to go out there and put himself in danger's way. You know, because I have a teenage son, and I have a wife, and I have, you know, a family that I need to take care of, because I know that if I did put myself in that position, I'd probably be one of the ones that's throwing the stones, and I need to be, you know, I need to be careful of that in my world. But I admire it that Tom does it, and I admire the artists that do it, and the musicians and the creators of chaos, that or the understanders of chaos, that want to go out there and say, this is not okay. And that's what punk rock is. It's okay to not be good at this and play music, and it's not okay for people to be treated like this. And that's what punk rock stands for, is we're here to tell you that this is not okay. And music is there to support that. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm rambling on about what I'm trying to say there, but you know, I just really admire Tom and you know, what he's doing right now, because this administration's, you know, completely fucked.
Yeah. Like, no, I'm definitely everything that's going on in Los Angeles, and certainly everything that's going on with the administration, even watching from up here in Canada, is just, it's everyone's worst nightmare to watch play out. And it's interesting going back to Rage Against the Machine, and to look at Rage Against the Machine, Chumbawamba, and a band that you're very familiar with, Midnight Oil, as being maybe the three most overtly political bands that achieve yeah. sort of some level of mainstream acceptance, awareness, and to kind of look at what happened with them and how they tried to navigate that. And I don't know, it's interesting. Like, I'd love to hear from, I think Tom and Zach from Rage Against the Machine would have very different opinions on the Rage Against the Machine experiment and how it went.
Yeah.
Because it really does show you that times that you can make your whole thing being political. You can, you know, you can just make that your band and people will still fucking ignore the lyrics.
Yeah. No, I mean, so, I mean, you see it every day on, you know, Twitter and shit. People talk shit about those guys. And it's like, what did you think they were doing? Like this, yeah. the name of the band is Rage Against the Machine, you know? And fuck, I remember the first time I heard that, the first record, we were down here in Los Angeles. We'd come down to do a showcase for a label. We'd been seen in Seattle and they flew us down to play for their label head. And I forget her name, the woman from Sony who played it for me in the car. And I was like, whoa, this is fucking killer. You know, like, yes, this is what the world needs right now. And that was, you know, 19 fucking 93 or 92 rather. So, you know, or 93, I don't remember, but, yeah, I mean, but I'm certain they would have different opinions of what that band's creative energy or, you know, Zach is so, God, man, he's so smart. He's so like, lyrically violent and visceral and just there's so much in there that I love and admire, and yeah, it's a band that I wish that I was in. Like, it's like I would love to have been in that fucking band, or you know, or Midnight Oil, or even Chumbawamba. Like you're saying, like these are, you know, a lot of people laugh at Chumbawamba and you know, just that whole kind of hit that they had, but they were really, really political, and they still are, and they had, you know, they had some really important shit to talk about, and people just fucking, it went right over their heads. You know, went right over their heads. And because you're like you said, no one will bother to take time to read the lyrics or listen to them. They'll just sing them, you know?
Yeah. And that's the unfortunate thing about, I guess, and maybe the fortunate thing about art, but once you make it and put it out in the world, you have no control over who takes it in or how they take it in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of, I don't know if this is art or what, but, did you ever talk to Henry Rollins about Madonna? Because you guys were on Maverick, and there's always that rumor about them having the relationship. And I was just wondering if that ever came up.
I don't know. I don't think we ever talked about that. I know the rumor, but I don't, like I said, you know, the only conversation I had with him was that last night in Hamburg on tour. So I'm certainly not going to say, hey, did you fuck Madonna? But yeah, I think, I know that he had done some work in that studio that was attached to Maverick Records down here in LA. It was called Brooklyn Studios. And maybe she had gone in there and, you know, while he was working. I mean, that's kind of what I heard, but, you know, I honestly, I don't know. And I would highly doubt that Henry would, you know, stoop that low, but yeah, you know, stranger things would happen, I suppose. He was always chasing it, you know, always chasing it.
What was that? So, cause like the thing that's fascinating to me is always these bands, not always these bands, but when bands go from the demo to the major label, it's like, I guess like a, I don't, once again, this is going to show my ignorance about sports, but I imagine it's like going from like playing in high school to playing in the major league or the NBA or something like that, where it's like from the pan into the fire type thing where you don't really get that sort of slow warm up. And it's a fascinating thing. I've talked to the guys from, you know, different bands that have had that happen to them. And it's, I think it must have been, what was it like to kind of experience that from going from like a demo to all of a sudden you are being flown out to LA?
It's strange. I mean, the funniest thing was we got flown down to play for EMI SBK, which Fred Davis was running, Clive Davis's son. And he didn't even show up at the showcase. But then Guy Osiri happened to be there because his attorney said, hey, SPK's flown this band from Seattle down that everybody's talking about. You should go to the show. So we played at Club Lingerie, and Guy was there, and he called Freddie from the show and said, look, I think we need to take a look at this band Candlebox. But it was, you know, I think that the reality didn't really set in until we played in at Madison Square Garden with Rush. I mean, that was like all of a sudden, you know, yes, you make the demo and then you make your first record and you go on tour and you're in a van and you're doing all that sort of stuff. And then you go out and you play some shows with Living Color. You're like, this is amazing. Living Color, what a great band. And then all of a sudden, hey, you're going to do, you know, 3 months with Rush starting in the new year of 94. And you're like, wait a second, what are you talking about? But then you go into a place like Madison Square Garden with Rush and it all kind of settles and it sinks in to a point where like, I literally thought I was going to vomit. I was standing on the side of the stage right before we went on. And I'm like, I'm going to throw up. I was like, what's wrong with you? I can't believe we're playing Madison Square Garden. Like, they're like, we're on tour with Rush. And I'm like, yeah, but this is the fucking cathedral, you know, for a lead singer. We've all seen videos of all the greatest bands of all times playing there. You know, it's like, that is the cathedral. And that's, I think what for me, made me realize this might be the greatest job in the world, but it's also the hardest thing that I will ever do. And, you know, and that's, you know, obviously it's not, but you know, that's what your brain tells you, because of course I wasn't ready for, you know, the rise in stardom, and I wasn't ready for the money, and I wasn't ready for everything being thrown at me, because there's no one to teach you how to deal with that sort of stuff. I mean, you have your parents you could talk to, but you know, my dad was a hell of a lot older than my mother. And, you know, and even though he was a musician, I'm not going to call him and, hey, dad, you know, I'm getting all this shit thrown at me. What do I do? Because he'd have been like, take it, you know. But yeah, it was a very, very weird experience. And I think also having that kind of sit down dinner with Freddie DeMann, who was running Maverick, he flew up to Seattle to sit down with us, and he brought the contract personally. And he's like, look, you know, my history with Madonna and Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, being a radio guy back in the day was, you know, he's in the Hitman book about the guys who were paying for payola at radio stations and shit with cocaine and whatnot. You know, he's like, I am planning on doing that for Candlebox. And if you guys will let me, I will take you to the stratosphere. I'll never forget him saying that. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm sitting with one of the most powerful men in the music industry, you know, I mean, right there with Mo Austin and all these other cats, you know, Freddie is one of those dudes. And just thinking, man, this is going to be a fucking crazy trip. And I hope I'm ready for it. And I wasn't, I certainly wasn't. And I'm still not. I mean, you know, 35 years later, I'm still doing it, or 32 years later, I'm still doing this shit. You know, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. There's like no preparation for when it happens kind of at any level. And you think the people at the label going through it as many times as they have and seeing how it goes for certain people and doesn't go for certain people would be at least aware enough to be like, listen, guys, this is going to be a bit of a mind fuck. But yeah. they're never like, they're always just like, this could be huge. This is going to be huge.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this for you guys, but it might eat you alive for a little bit too. So
get
ready.
Yeah.
What was opening for Rush like versus opening for like Metallica? Like, what's a Rush audience in 94? Like, that's Roll the Bones era, right?
Yeah. It's a lot of this. Fuck you. Same with Metallica. Fuck you. No, I mean, it was very similar because, you know, they were both so, and still, I mean, considered, you know, some of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time, Rush and Metallica, you know, and they were really kind to us. They were so, like, I remember we started in Pensacola, the first show, and we met Alex and Getty. And then we had like maybe Mississippi and Louisiana. And then we got to Austin, Texas. And after our show, Neil Peart came into our dressing room and he's like, sit, knock on the door and guys, mind if I come in? After we played, we're like sitting there. Yeah, no. And he's like, hey, so I've been watching you guys past 3 nights and I think I've got a really good set list for you. And we're like, what? Okay. And he's like, I want you to start with this song. Cause you know, he was such a mathematician and a genius when it came to like putting songs and lyrics and stuff together, because I think he was really the foundation of most of what Rush was creating when he joined the band from that moment on. And we stuck to that set list for the entire 3 months. And he was right. It worked. It was the perfect opener. It was the perfect middle, the perfect end. And they were genuinely the kindest musicians that we've ever toured with. And we've toured with some really brilliant ones and a bunch of fucking assholes. But those guys were, and still are. I mean, we were able to go down and see Geddy and Alex shortly after Neil's wife had passed and his daughter. And so we didn't get to say hi to him, but we went down to see them in Anaheim or whatever that place is down south, and amphitheater. I forget what it's called now. They've changed the name so many times, but it was an outdoor amphitheater. We went down to hang out with them, and we chatted for almost 2 hours, before they went on stage and just caught up. And, the fact that they were still remembered us from so many years prior, and we were able to just kind of catch up, and, it's something I'll never forget. And they were spectacular every single night. I mean, there was not, at the end of the tour, we gave them gifts. That's something that used to happen back in the 90s. It doesn't happen so much anymore, but you give the headliner gifts and thank yous for letting us play with you and tour with you guys. And Neil, we got him a right-handed catcher's mitt because he would throw his drumsticks every night. Sometimes he would catch them, sometimes he wouldn't, but he was so good at grabbing one out of the stick bag that it looked like he caught it. And so we got him a right-handed catcher's mitt. He knew exactly what that was, and he laughed his ass off. And the fact that we were able to kind of, become that type of a build that kind of a friendship, was pretty special to me.
They don't really get any credit for being a proto-punk band, but like you hear that first record, they're playing with the New York Dolls. They're playing with Teenage Head up here. They came from that same sort of cloth of hard rock. Obviously they went a different way, but it was kind of the same sort of direction for a while.
Yeah. They were great, man. And they would play some really deep cuts on that tour, man. It was cool.
I've heard you mention before, like you met all the Soundgarden guys through working at like a shoe store, right?
Yeah. Fluvox Shoes on First Avenue.
That's, they're a band that I feel also doesn't really get brought up in their punk connections, but like there's like Chris Cornell playing in the Center for Disease Control Boys Kim playing in Identity Crisis. Like they do have this sort of like Alice in Chains, I guess, is the one band that I don't know if there's any sort of punk connection with.
No, Lane, those guys were really pretty much metal guys. I mean, even Lane, Alice, Diamond Lie, Jerry's band and Alice in Chains, Lane's band, they were metal dudes. They were, they were listening to Maiden and Sabbath. And I mean, I'm sure that they're elements of their stuff that, were punk rock and maybe they were listening to it, but I don't think either one of them are in punk bands per se,
Well, you mentioned getting up there and how it's a lot more kind of rocky and slower and less kind of capital P punk rock, I guess, than San Antonio. Yeah. What were some of the bands that you did gravitate to when you first moved up there?
Accused. Yeah. I really liked those guys a lot. I love them. The Posies were one of my favorite. As I mentioned, the Fastbacks. A lot of that stuff. And the U-Men, we had a great station up there called K-Jet. It was an AM station, and that's where I heard all that stuff. And then some of those DJs, when that radio station died off, went and started, University of Washington station, which was great. So you had all these kind of really cool college things happening, college stations and like off the beaten path kind of, rock and roll shows happening. Like there was a shoe store on Broadway called Luna, which Malfunction used to play in. They would have concerts in there all the time. And then Fallout Records down on Second Avenue. That's where they had, I think it was Punk Fest, which was rad. It was a skateboard record store. And I saw the Accused there. And I also like Metal Church. I really liked those guys a lot. That they were great. And of course, Soundgarden and Screaming Trees were probably my favorite, out of like the contemporaries of what we were doing. Screaming Trees were probably my favorite. Mark Lanegan's always been kind of my favorite singer, from Seattle, but getting to know all those guys from working with Susan, cause she managed all those bands. And they would come into the store to pick up their flyers and you would tack onto the telephone poles. And so that's how I got to know all those guys and got to meet them. And, And hopefully they would call me a friend, but I certainly call them friend when we come in and sit down and we chat about music. So it was cool.
You brought Malfunction there, and that's a band that obviously the records came out and it's been reissued and things, but it seems like a band that unless you saw it, you're never going to really get it.
It was magical, man. Andy was just a fucking star, you know, and the fact that he and Chris were roommates and they would just like try to outright one another all the time, you know, it's so funny to think about those two just sitting in a room together and hopefully they're doing that now. But you know, Malfunction was such a fucking cool band, and you know, the makeup and Andy with the Steinberger bass, and you know, I still keep in touch with Regan, the drummer. We've been friends a long, long time. And Kevin Wood, actually, he's writing music again, and he's sent me some stuff. He's asked me to sing on it. So we're talking about maybe doing like a cool kind of a Malfunction punk rock record together, which would be amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
If Regan would agree to do it, you know, I'd be honored to do it, because Andy was to me just the sweetest, kindest, most amazing superstar I'd ever met.
Yeah. Like you brought up the drug stuff earlier, and it feels like there's a lot of tragedy with people that were just drugs and other reasons gone too soon. And the music that they put out would have, would have been very different. Like other Mother Love Bone, if that had kept going, or like, you know, there's things that could have happened that would have, changed the course of music maybe, or certainly would have had an impact, those bands.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if Mother Love Bone would have been as big as Pearl Jam? I don't know. People could argue all day long that they would have, but you know, I think it was so kind of, you know, the sweetness of Mother Love Bone against the bitterness of Pearl Jam, you know, I think is the difference, because I find Mother Love Bone to be, musically, it's just so warm and cozy and kind and loving. But at the same time, you know, Andy with his, you know, his shtick and all the kind of, you know, hey, can you see me in the balcony? And there's no balcony sort of thing, you know. Whereas, you know, Eddie brought that, he brought the bitterness that Pearl Jam needed. And I think that it was, you know, it was, sad, you know, sadly, it was what needed to happen, you know, with Andy dying, those guys needed to find that place, you know, and they needed some way to get rid of all of that frustration and all that hurt. Because, you know, as much as they loved Andy, he took a lot away from them. Even though he gave them a great opportunity, you know, there was a lot that band worked towards, and those drugs just, you know, heroin is, you know, it's a hell of a drug. It's killed so many Seattle musicians. It's killed so many musicians, but it's killed so many Seattle musicians. And that's the sad part of it. You know, I was lucky enough to avoid that. It scared the shit out of me. I did everything else, but I did not want to be, you know, rolling around on the floor looking like a zombie, you know, and it's just not, it wasn't attractive to me. And maybe it's the OCD side of me, but yeah, it just was something that I was fortunate enough to stay away from.
Yeah, there's never enough cautionary tales about it, because you look through the history of rock and roll, and I look at friends. I've lost a lot of friends, sadly, because of it. And it's no one ever wins going against it. Like there's I can't think of anyone that has come out of it completely changed by the experience or is gone forever because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, like speaking of Mark Lanegan, you know, his book, Read Backwards and Weep, you know, it tells the story of that Seattle music scene and how it also shows how influential Mark was on putting a lot of those bands together and bringing a lot of that Ellensburg angst and frustration, and the Bainbridge Island stuff to, you know, to a city that needed to maybe get its ass kicked a little bit, you know? But he speaks about it so eloquently in that book about the darkness of it and and the beauty of it and what it gave to him and what it took away from him. And, you know, sadly what it took away from his best friend, Lane, and Kurt as well, you know, cause he and Kurt were best friends. And he could not escape that feeling of, I don't deserve to be here. So I need this heroin to make me feel like I can be here, sort of thing. And I think that's, you know, imposter syndrome. I think Mark had that. I certainly have it. It's again, it's that ego, you know, that can find its way in and make you feel like maybe you just don't deserve something. So you turn to that drug that kind of makes you feel safe and warm. I was lucky enough, like I said, to avoid that. I don't know how I did. Maybe it was the fact that it just scared the shit out of me. And I was watching so many of my friends kind of go through withdrawals and sickness from it. So, but yeah, it had a hold of that city but it's also one of the reasons that city made the music that it made.
Yeah. Like going back to that imposter syndrome thing you just said, like, I feel like everyone who's a lead singer has that to a certain extent, because it's not a natural thing to be up there. And the most terrifying people are the people that don't have that, where you're like,
yep,
oh, I'm meant to be doing this. And people are meant to adore me and meant to look at me up here, yep, doing my thing. Like, I feel like it's a very natural thing. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I feel like every lead singer has it on some level, and they can mask it different ways. They can mask it by being an asshole and trying to be too cool. They can mask it by being like a tryhard like me, but we all have it.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, you gotta be a little bit off kilter to be a lead singer, you know? And that's the thing that, you know, I constantly remind myself all the time, is that I've put the work in. I don't deserve to be here, but I have a right to be here to say what I say and to sing what I sing, because I've worked hard to get here. But yeah, I mean, it's still, every time I step out on stage, you know, I am completely nervous before every show. Smallest, biggest, doesn't matter. I get really, really nervous, and you know, the mind starts going, what are the lyrics? Am I going to remember the, you know, and of course I'm going to remember them, but you know, luckily that tells me that I care about what I do, you know, is that I have that fear still 30 some odd years later, still scares the shit out of me to step out in front of people and sing.
Yeah. If the whole thing, the whole ride that we talked about hadn't happened, was your trajectory that, like, idealized when you guys are forming the band, was it kind of following what Screaming Trees were doing, like signing to like an SST, or like Soundgarden, I guess, was also on SST around then too, right? Like, is that kind of like where you saw yourselves kind of fitting in?
You see, Barty and I did, our bass player, because Barty and I, you know, again, he was going to, Barty went to a foreign exchange program in Ireland for our high school year. So I actually didn't know him. We went to high school together, but we weren't in class together because he was over in Ireland for school. So when I met him, we had so many kind of band, you know, concepts in common. There were so many things that we felt about what we wanted the music to sound like. So we were, you know, we would have loved to have signed to an SST or even Sub Pop or something like that. But, you know, there was Pete and Scott, who came from that world of, you know, Iron Maiden and Judas Priest and Aerosmith, and, you know, wanting to be, you know, the arena rock band. So we kind of lost that battle and signed to a major. But I would, you know, I think it's, you know, life is, I think it's written down for you long before you even fucking start it, you know? And I think that this was supposed to be the path, and this was supposed to be the career, and this was supposed to be the direction, and the things that happened to this band, the mistakes that were made, were supposed to happen, because it's, you know, it's all about learning a lesson, and, you know, you can't take any of this shit with you. So what do you do with it while you're here? That's what's important. And I think that if we'd assigned to an SST, we probably would have been a much more respected band. But then again, maybe not. Maybe we're like, who the fuck is Candlebox, and why are they on SST? They should be on, you know, they should be on Warner Brothers. They should be on some major label bullshit. So, you know, luckily it worked out. And, you know, I'm sitting here in front of a picture of Keith Richards that was given to me by Jim Marshall. you know, the photographer. I mean, it's just like my life has been pretty fucking incredible. And
you don't have a cat sitting on your master tape in Austin right now too. So it kind of all worked out.
There we go. I mean, you know, but yeah, I've been very, very fortunate. And I think that by staying grounded and keeping the friends around me that I have and paying attention to my life is why I'm still here.
Yeah. Like I feel like it's everything, like you're saying, everything kind of happens for a reason when you're in a band. And I feel like that's you just got to surrender yourself to that ride, because as soon as you try and resist it or try and steer it, you're going to crash that ship.
That's exactly right. And that's what I meant to say is, yeah, you're absolutely right. Don't try and steer it. I mean, you will go, if it's going to happen, it's going to go where it's going to go. And it doesn't have to be millions and millions of records. It's the fact that you're out there and people are seeing you play music and you're getting to do what you love. That in itself is the success that you're hoping for. And if it turns into something bigger than that, that's amazing. But you got to let it, like I said, you know, all of this is written down. You know, that's what the song Change is about. I was tripping on mushrooms when I was, you know, I woke up and I'd written those lyrics and I was like, oh my God, you know, did I tap into my, you know, is that my God speaking to me, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But it really was, that's what all I could think about at the time when I was writing those lyrics is like, man, this is all scheduled for me. And whatever the schedule is, I'm just going to go with it. And so maybe that was my epiphany, you know, at the ripe old age of 21, was that I'm just going to roll with it, you know, and see what happens.
Yeah. Also, Scott was in a band with Ken Stringfellow, right? Sky Cries Mary. Didn't they play on that record together too?
Yeah. Ken and Ken Scott and Gordon, who is a producer of the Strokes. Yeah. Yeah. Scott was in Sky Cries Mary. Actually, he left them to join Candlebox. Well, he left them to join this band we had prior with Rick Vaughn, who was a guitar player, worked at Reciprocal Studios. We called that band Uncle Duke, and then that became Candlebox. So that was, you know, a short-lived band. But Scott left Sky Cries Mary because he and Rick had been friends together and they'd worked on some stuff in the studio. And Scott had heard me sing at a birthday party and told Rick, hey, I know this kid, Kevin, who sings kind of like Chris Robinson and Andy Wood, and he's got this kind of Southern thing, in which I, you know, I come from Texas. So I know the formative years of my life, that's where I got it, you know, at the age of 10 to 13, you know, everything from Texas kind of stuck with me when I moved to Seattle. So I kind of had that, and I loved Chris's voice and Otis Redding, you know, and blues and all that sort of shit. So maybe that's kind of why Scott told Rick about me. And then Rick left like three or four weeks later and Pete joined the band. So we became Candlebox. So yeah, but it was very short lived with Rick, and Rick's a great guitar player and a hell of a songwriter. But you know, I think that he wasn't really feeling where we were headed. And, you know, but Scott was, he was that drummer that I always just was like, man, what a fucking phenomenal drummer. You know, it's all of his Steve Gadd kind of stuff, a little bit busy for most, you know, for most people, but for me, I love Steve Gadd. Being a drummer, I admired Scott's playing. I was super, super into what he was doing. And I had seen Sky Cries Mary. And he was also in Realms, which was a metal band with Kelly Gray or with Jeff Tate. One of the two. It was Realms and Myth. And I think Scott was in Realms and Kelly was in Myth with Jeff, or vice versa. So, you know, Scott had that kind of, you know, rock and roll background as well. So I think that's why he and Pete saw the arena rock, and Barty and I saw the let's stay down here sort of at the, you know, the cool punk rock club level. But you know, six one half a dozen the other, you know, years later here we are.
Yeah, you look at like the bands that found success, and it was because I've always heard it's divided in half, like there's the metal side of Seattle and there was like the punk side of Seattle, and when those two sides kind of came together, that's when you had bands that found that success. Like even Guns N' Roses, like looking at Duff moving to LA and hooking up with guys that were more rock, or Izzy, I guess, was punk too. But like, you kind of need the punk reality mixed with the guy that's like, yeah, but we're going to be in a stadium doing this.
Yeah. And that, those are some of the greatest bands of all time. You know, I mean, the Rolling Stones, the punk rock ethic and styles of Keith Richards versus, you know, Mick's swagger, Aerosmith, you know, there's tons of punk rock in what Aerosmith created. And, you know, and that's, I think that when you have that musician in the band that pulls the fuck you attitude, I don't give a shit about that. That's when you get really great stuff. And Duff was so, and Duff and Izzy, I mean, obviously so instrumental in what Guns N' Roses created, and what they still are. I mean, I got to know Duff years later after he had left Seattle. He bought a house down in Lake Washington, and I had moved into the neighborhood, and he used to come over and knock on my door and say, "Hey, we're going to go wakeboarding." You know? And I'm like, "Okay, what time?" He's like, "Be at my house in 15 minutes, you know? And I'd be like, "All right, I'll grab my swimsuit." I mean, that's how I got to know the guy, you know? And it was cool because he was genuine, and he actually was just a fucking cool dude that happened to be this badass from Guns N' Roses, you know? And but the farts and all that shit he was creating in Seattle were fucking killer.
I met Duff years ago when we did a Australian, like, kind of giant festival tour. And we were on it together, and I like went into his dressing room one day, just knocked on the door and was like, "Let's talk about the farts," and just punished the shit out of him. And that's when I realized I could do this podcast.
I was like,
"Oh, you can just talk to people about their punk rock stuff. And if they were actually from this world, they're going to have that sort of humble, real quality to them that you can't really ever shake. It's like a religion. It's like we all grew up in the same church. And it's stained us for better, I guess.
It's true. And I think that you have tapped into something, you know. I mean, listen, there's a million podcasts out there. And the great thing about them is it lets the listener into the world that you are inspired by, the world that you want people to hear about. And I'm just lucky enough that I experienced something that a lot of people don't get to experience, and someone wants to talk to me about it. And I'm always happy to have these conversations because there's so much about music that has given me so much freedom and so much love and so much joy. And, you know, I've tried to retire a couple of years ago, and it's not going to happen. You know, I get sucked back into this world because I love it. I remember standing on stage a couple of years ago when I thought that it was my last tour, and it was the last show of the tour. And I'm standing out there, I'm singing Far Behind. I was like, "Man, it's the last time I ever sing this song." And then I thought to myself, "You're an idiot. That's not the last time you're ever gonna sing this song. Go fuck yourself." But you know, like you have this grand vision of what it's gonna be. And ultimately it's just, God, I'm lucky to do what I love. And I'm lucky that this has given me this, you know, wonderful life. And I don't know how much fucking longer I have. I'm 56 years old. You know, I, for all I know, I could have some sort of fucking cancer right now. You know what I mean? You just don't know. And I want to enjoy every single minute of this. And I want to talk about the things that I experience. And thank you for having me on this podcast, dude, because this has been really fun for me. A lot of people don't know that I grew up, you know, on punk rock music, and that I love it as much as I do. And, you know, I'm just so, I really enjoyed this, man. Thank you.
Before you go, because I got to ask it, did you ever see the Fearless Iranians from Hell? Or were they going after you?
I did. No. So I used to go back to San Antonio. When I moved to Seattle, I went back every year to like see my friends and catch up. And my old girlfriend, I went back every year with her for prom. So I was able to see the Fearless Iranians from Hell. I love that band. They were, you know, again, my friend Reagan, who I mentioned earlier, Reagan Koblenz, she was, you know, best friends with all those guys. I mean, it just was what a great scene that San Antonio had, you know, and that Texas punk scene. I mean, the Hitboids are still touring, man. Like, I love that band so much, and I'm so fucking happy that they are still out there doing the shit at the age that they are, and people still want to see them, you know, because if you haven't seen the Hitboids, if no one, anybody that listens to the show has not seen the Hitboids, go see them, because you will fucking love them. They're an absolute blast to fucking see live.
So did you know Amir, the singer of Fearless Arena?
I did not know Amir.
They're still like a band that's surrounded in mystery to me. Like, they're a band that like people still think it was like, I guess there is a Butthole Surfers connection, but people talk about different bands that could have been the backing band. Yep. Like there's such a, talk about a band that needs a biopic too. It's like, I'd love to see a Fearless Iranians from Hell movie.
100%. You know, because I think that they were super instrumental in a lot of shit that happened in San Antonio in the mid 80s, late 80s. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. I should probably have my friend, you know, get you in touch with Reagan, because she has some of the craziest stories ever. about that scene in San Antonio. And I mean, because she's, you know, she'll tell a story about Kurt Cobain when he came through San Antonio and she was helping him look for records at Hogwild, and she didn't know who he was. And he asked her out for a coffee because she was that cute. And, you know, and she kind of looked like, the lead singer for Bow Wow Wow, Annabelle, you know, but, you know, with like winged glasses and stuff. She was just the coolest chick. And she's like, oh, I don't go out with customers and stuff. And then her boss came up and was like, what did Kurt Cobain buy? And she's like, he bought this. He's like, do you know who that is? She's like, I have no idea. You know, like she had no idea. And she could be with him today, like, or whatever. But, you know, it's she's got these great stories about that. But I know that she knew all the guys in Fearless and Flipper and all that stuff. And she could tell you some crazy fun stories about, you know, that scene and the Bone Club and all that stuff that was going on in San Antonio. It's pretty special. It was a really, really cool movement. And I'm so lucky to have seen a lot of that shit that I saw.
Well, anytime you want to come back on here, Kevin, and talk about Seattle, San Antonio, anywhere,
thank you.
You're always welcome.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. This has been an absolute blast.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.